trials. Don't you love life's trials? No? In life, we face all types of trials. One type of trial that we might face takes place in a courtroom with a judge and a jury. We definitely hate those types of trials, but they're very few and far between. No, the type of trials that we typically experience are those day-to-day types of trials, those everyday frequent annoyances and afflictions and troubles that come our way. The trials that we face, well, they're typically a result of relationships with other people. When you bring two people together, you tend to get trials. Well, whether it's your spouse that just doesn't understand you at all, or whether it's your teenage child who just won't listen to you, whatever it might be, everyone this morning is facing some sort of trial. This morning's study is all about transcending life's trials, because I'm sure that everyone here this morning desires to go beyond the trials in life. I'm sure we've thought to ourselves, if I can just get beyond this difficult time in my life, but how? What's the best way to go beyond the everyday difficulties that keep us from really enjoying life? Well, in our text today, we're going to see three different ways that people attempt to transcend life's trials. The first thing we're going to see is projection. We're going to watch as the Jewish leaders try to project their problems onto Paul. We'll also see proposition. We'll see as Paul deals with his problems by proposing logical solutions. And then finally, we'll see procrastination. We'll see as Felix, the governor, just wants to procrastinate from handling the problems and the trials of his life. And so let's look at the first point, that being projection. Projection is one way in which we attempt to transcend life's trials. But really, what we project onto others is only a reflection of the things that we need to really understand about our own selves. Here's what projection is. Projection is the ascription of one's own attitudes, feelings, or desires to someone else as a defense against our own anxiety and our own guilt. Projection is simply this. It's blame shifting. It's finger pointing. Rather than considering our own guilt in a trial, we just point the finger at those around us. When life's trials arise, projection is one way in which we unconsciously shift blame and personal guilt from ourselves to others. Let's watch as the Jewish leaders here attempt to solve their Paul problem with projection. Look at Acts chapter 24 with me, beginning in verse 1. Now after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, "Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace, and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple. And we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law, but the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. Well, let's stop right there and consider what's going on. Paul is on trial, a literal trial, but it's also a trial in his life, something that he's facing and having to deal with. Paul is dealing with one of life's trials. Well, he was, first of all, nearly killed by a Jewish mob because of false accusations from a handful of Jews from Asia. The Roman commander Lysias arrested him and sought to discover from the Jewish leaders what he was accused of. And the Jewish leaders, well, when they brought Paul before them, they only argued about the resurrection, but brought no formal charges against Paul. Well, it was discovered that there were over 40 Jews who were going to kill Paul, and so the Roman commander Lysias sent Paul to Felix. Well, the Jewish leaders, they came 5 days later. So Paul has been sent to Governor Felix, and they wait for the accusers to come. And here they are 5 days later, and they brought the Johnny Cochran of their time. They brought a guy named Tertullus. Look at Acts 24, verse 1 again. Now, after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. Now, this guy Tertullus, very interesting character here. The Jews, they had taken this position that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They had hired this Roman lawyer named Tertullus. His name, well, it means triple hardened. And it only really represents the heart of the Jewish leaders. Their hearts were triple hardened against the gospel that Paul preached. But they hired this Roman orator who knew how to butter up and speak Romanese to the Roman governor, Felix. Look at verse 2 again. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, "Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us." Someone wants to be teacher's pet. Someone's trying to get in the good graces of Governor Felix here. Now, we should all be thankful for honest lawyers, because honest lawyers, they seek truth and justice and try to bring that to a case at hand. But I'm not so sure that Tertullus was one of those honest lawyers that we should be thankful for. No, Tertullus failed to seek either truth or justice. He was merely a hired gun with no smoking gun. He was hired to project the guilt of the Jewish leaders onto Paul. The Jewish leaders, they had hired Tertullus to project their guilt. And they did this in three areas. They projected the guilt of their responsibility. They projected the guilt of their culpability. And they projected the guilt of their lack of accountability onto Paul. Let's consider those three areas. First, the projection of responsibility. Look at Acts 24, verse 5. It says, "We have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple." And so he's saying, hey, look, who's responsible for this trial? Why are we here bugging you, taking up your time, most noble Felix? Well, it's Paul's fault. That's what Tertullus is suggesting. The blame for this trial and taking up the time of an important man like Felix, it's Paul's fault. It's his responsibility. He's saying, look, Felix, we wouldn't be here bothering you, taking up your precious time, if it wasn't for Paul, because he's a plague, he's a creator of dissension, he's a ringleader, he's an all-around bad guy. But was Paul truly responsible for this trial? No. No, he wasn't. We've already seen that the Jewish guys from Asia that accused Paul, well, they were false accusations. They had borne false witness against Paul. We already watched as the Jews could not bring formal charges against Paul before Lysias. So Commander Lysias, well, he sent Paul to Felix simply to avoid Paul's murder by these 40 Jews who wanted to kill him. So the responsibility of why Paul is standing before Governor Felix? Well, it's the fault of the Jewish leaders. It's their fault that this trial is going on. Paul's been falsely accused. There's an attempt on his life. And so that's why the trial is happening. The responsibility for this trial? Well, it lay at the feet of the Jewish leaders. The Jewish religious leaders, it's their responsibility. Well, they move from responsibility to projecting culpability. Culpability, it speaks of being deserving of punishment for wrongdoing. And the Jewish leaders had already determined Paul's culpability. They had already determined that he was guilty and deserving punishment. Acts 24:6, in the second half of the verse, says this: "We seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law." They had already seized him, and they had already passed the judgment. They were ready to punish him now for the crimes that Paul was accused of. Well, the punishment would be a good stoning. They wanted to take Paul out and stone him. They wanted to rip him into pieces. They wanted to kill him. The problem, however, is that the charges against Paul, well, they were false. The accusations were false accusations. And so he wasn't deserving of the punishment. Paul was not culpable. On the other hand, the Jewish leaders, well, they were. Not only were they responsible, but tried to project the responsibility onto Paul, they were also culpable, but they tried to pass the culpability onto Paul. Let's consider what the crime of a false accusation was according to Jewish law. Deuteronomy 19:16 says this: "If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is false, who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother." You see, if someone bears false witness, according to the Old Testament law, the person who bore false witness is actually culpable for what they were accusing the other person. And so that person becomes deserving of the punishment that they suggested for the one that they falsely accused. Therefore, it's the Jewish leaders who were truly culpable. They were the ones deserving the stoning for falsely accusing Paul and wanting to stone him. These guys were truly the ones who were culpable. Well, consider this. Their projection of culpability went so much more deeper than this. These Jewish leaders are the same Jewish leaders who falsely accused Paul. They falsely accused Christ. The ones who accused Paul are the ones who accused Christ. The ones who accused Paul in this trial are the ones who sent Christ to the crucifixion on the cross based on false accusations. And so not only were they culpable for the false accusations against Paul, they were culpable for the false accusations against Christ. They sent Christ to die on the cross. The biggest problem for them, though, the evidence that they were false witnesses, because Jesus Christ didn't stay in the grave. On the third day, he rose from the dead, proving that his claims were genuine, that they were true, that he was who he claimed to be. And so with Christ's resurrection came the evidence that these Jewish leaders, well, they had falsely accused an innocent man. The problem is that they began a charade. They began a charade that they have to continue now. They have to continue this pointing the finger, this laying of blame against anyone who would stand with Christ. Because the minute they give in, then what they really suggest is that they're culpable for the crucifixion of Christ. Well, this is why they wanted to find Paul guilty. And so through Tertullus, they projected their culpability onto Paul. But finally, let's consider the projection of their accountability. You see, these Jewish leaders wanted Paul to be accountable to Felix, but they didn't want to be accountable for their own accusations. Acts 24:7 says, "But the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. You see, Tertullus was suggesting that Paul is the only one who really needs to be examined. There doesn't need to be any kind of cross-examination. There's no point in asking the Jews to actually provide the evidence. The very fact that they're accusing Paul is evidence enough, right? Wrong. Wrong. They want Paul to be accountable for his actions, but they're unwilling to be accountable for what they were claiming. They didn't have a smoking gun. They didn't have any evidence. But they didn't want to be accountable for that either. They didn't want to be accountable for the mistakes that they made. They didn't want to be accountable for falsely accusing Paul. They didn't want to be accountable for falsely accusing Christ. They just wanted Paul to be accountable for what they accused him of. Well, we need to understand that the Jewish leaders did not want to be examined. They did not want to be scrutinized. They just wanted Felix to be on their side. So the Jewish leaders projected their responsibility, they projected their culpability, and they projected their lack of accountability onto Paul in order to transcend this trial. That's the Jewish leaders. What about you? What about me? Are we also guilty of trying to transcend life's trials through projection? Consider this. Do you ever find yourself blaming others before considering your own responsibility in a matter? When a trial rises between you and somebody else, oh, it's easy to just go, oh, it's all their fault. If there's a problem between me and somebody else, clearly it's their fault. And I have no responsibility in the matter. I am free and clear of all guilt. Is that how we act? Is that how we treat one another? It's wrong. It's wrong. It takes two to dance. And when there's trials and when there's problems that arise between people, typically, there's guilt on both sides. Do you ever accuse others of having undesirable traits that you yourself have? That's right. We do that, don't we? What about this? Have you ever expected others to be accountable in ways that you don't expect yourself to be? Oh, well, they need to be accountable for this and for that, and yet you have no accountability whatsoever. But aren't you just as guilty as they? So why do we expect others to be accountable in ways that we don't expect ourselves to be accountable? You might be trying to transcend life's trials through projection when you act in these ways. Be careful when you complain about the characteristics of others or the actions of others. Your complaints about others all too often only reveal your very character. Your accusation against others, well, they all too often reveal the sins of your own life. So be careful how you accuse others. Before you spend your time and your energy pointing the finger at others, understand this. Blame shifting will never solve any problem. It's been said that when you point the finger at someone else, you've got three pointing right back at you. Three times as much finger pointing comes with pointing the finger. Projection is simply a charade. It's a charade that gives the sense that we're transcending life's trials, but eventually all those issues that we project, they will come home to roost. They will be laid at your own doorstep, and it will be worse than if you would have just dealt with the trial when it was there. Projection is no way to transcend life's trials. You will not get beyond those trials. They will only come back to try you again. So be careful. Be careful when we project our own guilt onto other people. Well, what about proposition? As we can see, projection is not a good way to transcend life's trials. But proposition might be a pretty good way. Let's consider what a proposition is. A proposition is a logical term. It refers to a statement that affirms or denies something. A proposition is also the act of offering or suggesting something to be considered, accepted, adopted, or done. And in the context of this study, we're talking about a proposition in this sense. It's the act of proposing a logical solution to the trial at hand. It's not enough to just complain and point the finger. We ought to propose ways in which the trial can be dealt with. Look at Acts chapter 24, beginning in verse 10. It says, "Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, 'Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And they neither found me in the temple, disputing with anyone nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city, nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. Now, after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with mob nor tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object, if they had anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves say, if they have found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council, unless it is for this one statement which I cried out, standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. Let's stop right there and consider Paul's proposition. Paul's proposition here begins with an examination of the accusations. He examines the accusation, first of all, in light of the time frame. Acts 24:11b again says, "It is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship." You see, it's only been 12 days. How in the world could you somehow put together a whole dissension and a mob to go against all of Jerusalem in 12 days? He's saying, look, what they're accusing me of would be impossible to pull off in a 12-day period of time. It's impossible. Well, then he compares their accusations to what really happened. You see, Tertullus accused Paul of being three things: a creator of dissension among all the Jews, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, and that he even tried to profane the temple. False, false, and false. Paul challenges these accusations in verse 12. Look at Acts 24:12 with me again. It says, "They neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city." He's saying, hey, you didn't find me with any Nazarenes. You didn't find me with a mob in the temple. You didn't find me arguing with anybody in the temple or in the synagogue or in the city. So where are these accusations coming from? He didn't stir up a crowd. He didn't dispute in the temple. No, he wasn't guilty of what Tertullus accused him of. Well, next, Paul exposes the total lack of evidence on their part. They had no smoking gun. Look at Acts 24:13. He says, "Nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me." We'll come back to this point. He's proclaiming the burden of proof on the Jewish leaders. We'll look at that last. But let's continue to look at Paul's proposition, because Paul points to three elements to propose his innocence. He points to confession, to constitution, and then to conscience. And so look at Acts 24:14, because Paul begins by confessing what he is guilty of. He says, "But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets." So remember that Christianity in the first century was called the way. And it was considered a sect, and it was. And he's saying, look, I worship according to the way, but what that really looks like is that I worship the God of the Old Testament, and I believe not in half of the prophecies, but in all of the prophecies. He calls it the law and the prophets. That's the way we call it today, the Old Testament. The law and the prophets, this is the Old Testament. And he's saying, look, I don't believe just in half of the prophecies from the Old Testament. I believe in all of them. I believe in the fulfillment of the Messiah in Jesus Christ. And so therefore I worship God as was intended through the Old Testament. And so if I'm guilty of something, I confess I'm guilty. I'm guilty of worshiping the God of the Old Testament. Well, how could a Jew find a problem with people who worship the God of the Old Testament? At this point in time, there was no Jewish law against worshiping the God of the Old Testament. At this point in time, there was no Roman law against worshiping the God of the Old Testament and worshiping Him in His fullness and worshiping Him in His fulfillment of sending the Messiah, and that being Jesus Christ. Well, next Paul says, I'm guilty. I'm guilty of worshiping the Messiah because the Messiah is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. And this is his confession to guilt. Well, next Paul points to constitution. And a constitution, it's a system of fundamental principles according to which a nation is governed. And the nation of Israel was governed based on biblical principles and biblical doctrines. One of those principles was the future hope of a physical resurrection. And so Acts 24:15, he says, I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. You see, Paul proposes his innocence based upon the constitutional principle of the resurrection of the dead. While there was some debate in this time period between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection of the dead, the Sadducees didn't. And there was this debate going on about the resurrection. But let's depart from a debate within Israel and understand that constitutional principles are not based on sects within Israel, but based on the Old Testament itself. And the Old Testament clearly taught the principle of the resurrection of the dead. The Lord revealed to the prophet Daniel that Israel shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. That's Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. You can also find this constitutional principle of the resurrection in Job chapter 19, in Isaiah chapter 26, in Hosea chapter 13, and all throughout the New Testament. So Paul, he's not teaching anything that contradicts basic Jewish fundamental principles that were constitutional. Well, next Paul proposes his innocence based on his conscience. Acts 24:16, he says this, "This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men." So he's saying, look, I've confessed my guilt. I'm guilty of worshiping God. I've confessed that I believe in the resurrection, but hey, that's a constitutional principle. And I confess that in my conscience, I'm free and clear. I'm all good with God, and I should be all good with men. But next is proposition. Well, he seals his case. He proves his innocence by coming to what we call burden of proof. Burden of proof is the responsibility of proving a case or an argument, especially in a court of law. And the burden of proof is always on the accuser. You see, when someone comes and accuses somebody, the burden of proof is on them to prove their case. Paul basically says, you guys want to accuse me? Fine. You guys want to take me to trial? I'm here. I'm not complaining. However, you've got the burden. Prove it. If I'm guilty, prove it. Look at Acts 24:17. Now, after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with mob nor tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. That's right. The original accusers, the Jews from Asia that had brought him up on these false charges, they weren't even here. They weren't even present. The eyewitnesses were nowhere to be found. He's saying those who are these original accusers, these guys who brought me before the council in Jerusalem, where are they? Where are the eyewitnesses? Well, for those who were present, the ones who had come from Jerusalem to accuse Paul before Felix, he asks the questions of them. He says, why didn't they offer up formal charge before the council back in Jerusalem? Acts 24:20 says this, or else let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council, unless it is for this statement which I cried out, standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. So Paul chooses to transcend this trial with logical argumentation. He puts forth a proposition. He's saying, look, I propose that I'm innocent. Here's the evidence that what I'm saying is true. But now if you have something to accuse me of, if you have some evidence of wrongdoing, well, put it before Felix and let's examine it. Let's consider it. His accusers, well, they wanted to establish Paul's guilt, but they didn't have any evidence. They didn't have the smoking gun. We can take from this a lesson of understanding one of the better ways in transcending life's trials. One of the best ways that we can transcend life's trials is through logical proposition. It's better than projection. Because if we have a propensity towards projection, then we won't be as open to the possibility of our own guilt. If we're too busy trying to prove that everyone around us is in error and we're okay, then we're not open to any new information and our blind spots remain blind spots. But if we engage in the art of proposition, suggesting that, yeah, I think I'm innocent. Here's the evidence that I can see of why I'm innocent of these wrongdoings. At the same time, I'm willing to hear what others have to say about it. I'm willing to listen to the evidence if you have any. And if you do, if you're an eyewitness of that evidence, then put it before me. Let's examine it. Let's consider it. And that way we can be open to the possibility that we ourselves might be guilty of causing some of our own trials. Oh, it's easy to just think that everybody else, well, they're the ones that are causing the trials in my life. And if we can't find someone else to blame, it's Satan. There's a whole theological group of Christians out there that every problem in their life is Satan. Well, Satan's not everywhere at once. Right? So they all can't be Satan's problems. And everybody else around you can't always be the guilty ones. Chances are sometimes you might be guilty too. And if we engage in the art of proposition, proposing our innocence, but being willing to accept the fact that we might be guilty if we listen to the evidence of others, we might do well in dealing with the trials that come our way. And in dealing with the trials, we will transcend them. We will transcend life's trials. Well, when it comes to transcending life's trials, proposition is sure to present us with the best opportunity to soar above the troubles of life. But as we've seen, projection, well, it's not a very good way. It's just blame shifting, and eventually those trials will catch back up with us. But let's look at a third way that people attempt to solve the problems in their life and transcend the trials. It's the way of procrastination. Procrastination, the act of inaction. Procrastination, well, they sometimes, those who procrastinate, they might ask themselves this question, well, why do today what I can put off till tomorrow, right? Or they might just consider themselves to have the mañana mentality. Let's consider what Acts 24 says here, beginning in verse 22. It says, but when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case. So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now, as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. Understand that Felix here places Paul under house arrest. He wasn't bound in chains. He wasn't put in some dark, dank prison. He was probably in some house somewhere where he was under arrest, but free to have the liberties of visitors, and those visitors could come and provide for him. And so it was arrest, but it wasn't, you know, probably a horrible way to go. And he said, you know what, we're going to deal with your case, and I'll determine whether you're guilty or not when Lysias comes. What's sad about that, though, is that this is the last mention of Lysias in all of the New Testament. Did Lysias come? Did he show up? We don't know. Was he on his way? Was he en route? We don't know. Did Felix send for him and say, hey, there's this thing going on and we're waiting for you to get here. Could you come? We don't know. All we know is that this is the last time Lysias is ever mentioned in the New Testament. Did the trial happen? Did he make a decision? Here, you know what's going on? Felix is just saying, I'm gonna wait and deal with this later. I'll wait until Lysias gets here. Don't know if he's en route. He doesn't have his BlackBerry turned on, so I can't email him. But when he gets here, we'll deal with this. So you'll just be under house arrest. Well, during this time of house arrest, Felix and his wife Drusilla listened to Paul's preaching. They brought Paul before him, and in verse 24, it says, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning faith in Christ. I'm sure they got an earful. I'm sure that, as the text says, they now had a more accurate understanding of the way. Look at Acts 24:25. Now as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, "Go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you." So Felix and Drusilla heard about righteousness. They heard about self-control, and they heard about the judgment to come. I'm sure Paul took the time to explain that only the righteous can enter into heaven. You see, only those who are holy can enter into a holy heaven. The minute someone who is unholy enters into heaven, well, then heaven becomes unholy. And so only those who are holy, only those who are righteous can enter into a holy place. It would go against God's character to allow the unrighteous to enter heaven. No, that's not going to happen. I'm sure Paul also revealed that we've all failed to attain to our own righteousness. We've all blown it. We've all made mistakes. You see, righteousness is simply this: right all the time. Now, this will just take a second, a scientific experiment. Hands up, who's righteous? Oh, nobody. So none of us are righteous. None of us are right all the time. But I could ask the question again. How many of us here have put on Christ's righteousness? That's right. I would hope that every hand in this room would go up. Because if we want to enter into heaven, we must be righteous. And the only hope that we have of that is to put on Christ's righteousness. When Christ makes us holy, we are holy. And we can enter into heaven because of His holiness. I'm sure that Paul took the time to explain all of this to Felix. And I'm sure that he called Felix to a day of decision and said, "Felix, today is the day of salvation. You're not going to make it when the judgment comes." And he described the coming judgment, the day that we'll all stand before God, and the day that God will separate the sheep from the goats. And those that are His will enter in, but those that aren't His will enter into everlasting punishment. And Felix was afraid. Felix was afraid because of the words of a prisoner. Felix had fear, and so he procrastinated his decision. He procrastinated his decision to try Paul and to make a decision about Paul. Then he procrastinated his decision about what to do with Jesus Christ. This is the greatest trial that Felix must face. This is the greatest trial of his life. What am I going to do with Jesus Christ? The fear of death, the fear of judgment, it was right there at his doorstep. And his reaction, well, it's all too common to people today. He says, "Go away. Go away. I'll deal with this at a more convenient time." People today are waiting for a convenient moment to submit their lives to Christ. And I'll tell you this right now, God's not running a 7-Eleven, and He's not concerned about your convenience. He's concerned about your obedience. He wants you to come to Him and submit your life to Him. And I'll tell you this right now as well, there will not come a convenient day to do what you don't want to do. A convenient moment, it'll never show itself. When is there ever going to be a convenient moment to do what your flesh doesn't want to do? It'll never happen. And so choose you this day who you will serve. Well, so concerning Paul, Felix was a procrastinator. Concerning Christ, Felix was a procrastinator. And he continues to procrastinate the situation at hand. Look at Acts 24:26. Meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given him by Paul, that he might release him. Therefore, he sent for him more often and conversed with him. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix, and Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound. You see, he was procrastinating his decision with Paul. For 2 years, Paul sat in prison. For 2 years, Felix waited to make the decision. Did he ever choose Christ? We don't know. I do hope that we do find Felix in heaven. But here he's procrastinating this decision to deal with Paul. Why? Well, because he doesn't want to deal with a bunch of angry Jewish leaders. He's fearful of the repercussions of releasing Paul. And he's probably thinking, hey, you know what? For a little bit of money, it'll be worth my while. And so I'll wait around for Paul to give me enough money. And if he gives me enough money to deal with all this, then I'll deal with it. But until that money comes, I don't want to even mess with it. He procrastinated the decision. Whatever the situation was, Felix was a procrastinator. When it came to the trial of Paul, Felix procrastinated making a decision. He left the Paul problem to his successor, Festus. We'll see in weeks to come as Paul stands before Festus and proclaims Christ once again. When it came to Christ, Felix procrastinated making a decision. He wanted to wait for a more convenient time. But enough about Felix. What about you? And what about me? How many of us are working really hard to procrastinate the problems that come our way? When life's trials come and we're faced with a fear, when we're faced with a dilemma, do we procrastinate? Do we just put it off? Do we try to dance around the situation or the issue? We think that transcending life's trials is best accomplished by simply waiting for a more convenient time to tackle the issues. But there never will be that convenient time for us. Let me challenge you with this. The convenient time that we're waiting for will never come. Because it's always inconvenient to deal with life's trials. It's always inconvenient to try to think through logical solutions to solving our problems. It's always going to be easier to just project our own guilt onto others or procrastinate and just try to put it off to a more convenient moment. But if you want to transcend life's trials, face the trial and deal with it. Face it head on and see what it is and examine yourself to find out if you're guilty or not. Don't allow fear or convenience or money or popularity to get in the way of dealing with life's trials. You see, Felix, he had fear, and so he said, go away. I don't want to deal with this right now. He wanted convenience to solve this problem or money. How many of us are waiting for more money so that we can finally tackle these problems? We feel a conviction to give at church, but oh, if I just had a little more money, then I can start obeying God. I've got this situation that I need to provide for kids from a previous marriage, but if I can just get some more money, then I'll provide for the kids that I had. We always use our lack of money as a way of procrastination. Or what about popularity? Well, if I make this decision, if I do this thing, then people won't like me. And so I'm just going to put this off until I just have to deal with it. Because we want to be liked rather than right. Don't allow fear or convenience or money or popularity to keep you from doing the right thing and transcending life's trials. Face them. And face them logically. But most importantly, face them spiritually. Because if you want to transcend life's trials, and I know that you do, and so do I, we must face them. But the good news is this. We don't have to face them alone. We don't have to face our trials alone. God knows how hard a thing it is to face life's trials. And that's why Paul informs us of the heart of God in 1 Corinthians 10:13. Here's what Paul wrote. No trial has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Aren't those beautiful words? I hope that gives you hope this morning as you're facing trials in your life today. Whatever trial you're faced with today, whatever people problems you're having, whatever thing that you're just not wanting to deal with and procrastinate or maybe whatever you're projecting onto other people, you need to face those trials. But you don't have to face them alone. No, the trials that come into your life, they're common to everyone else in this room. They're common to men. We all face like trials. But God, Paul reveals, God is faithful. God is so faithful that He's already made a way of escape, a way to help you bear up underneath that problem and then to go beyond, to transcend them. And Jesus Christ is that way of escape. Jesus Christ is the way that God has provided for us the escape of the guilt and the shame, the pain. An escape for every trial that comes our way is found in Jesus Christ. It begins by starting a relationship with Him, by submitting our lives to Him, by deciding, yes, today, Lord, I receive You as my Savior. And from that point in time of conversion, when we submit our lives to Him, continuing to come back to Christ, receiving the strength and the power of the Holy Spirit to face the trials at hand and to overcome them, to transcend beyond them. God has already prepared for us a way of escape, and His name is Jesus. So that by the power of the Holy Spirit and by the strength of Christ, you can move beyond the trials of life to the glory of God the Father. Let's pray.